Hello, and welcome to 4Panel, the independent podcast part of the Geek Show Network that deals with all things comic, manga, and other sequential illustrated media related things. I ran out of words there. Sorry about that. I'm joined, as usual, by Rob.
Hello.
And Andrew.
I like that we have Mick now and we can just force him to do all the introductions.
Mick's good at introduction.
And you'll notice I don't put in any spurious and unwarranted adjectives before our names.
Well, they might be unwarranted, but I don't think they're spurious.
I think the very fact that they're unwarranted makes them spurious.
No, are you saying you aren't incredible?
I am.
See?
I am saying I'm not incredible.
Oh, right.
I'm very credible.
Well, thank goodness we've got that sorted. I mean, I know that's been a cloud hanging over the show's head for many a week now.
How are you guys this week?
Well, I'm in a fit of ennui brought on by my cinematic experiences, of which I'll talk more later.
I'm also somewhat perturbed, because I thought of a funny response to that before the show, and I've completely forgotten it.
But enough about us. How are you, Rob?
Roasting in this tiny room.
You see, I'm now beginning to think that you do these podcasts like live from your oven.
It is kind of like an oven. But anyway,
I get worried that you're just underneath the floorboards.
Don't, because I almost got into a fight with a rat yesterday. Not in my house, in someone else's house.
Okay.
I mean, that's a bit to unpack.
That is. You can't just leave us and our listeners on that little bombshell.
Was it some kind of territorial dispute?
I walked into my cousin's kitchen, and there's this rat in the middle of the floor just staring at me. I'm looking at the rat. It's looking at me. It's like,
I want to finish saying hello to your cousin. Yeah. I'm really sorry, Rob's cousin. That was a harsh joke.
He is a bit rodentish. I'll give you that. But yeah, it definitely wasn't my cousin. It was a lot hairier than my cousin and a lot smaller. But it was still huge. I haven't seen rats that big for a while.
Are you sure your cousin hadn't bought a dog and not informed you?
Yep. So, yeah, I'm getting glared at by this rat as if I've just walked into, like, its den of iniquity or something like that and disturbed it.
Well, in fairness, you probably had.
I was looking at the rat. It was looking at me. It was like high noon. I was getting ready for a rumble. Me versus rat.
I've now got an image of a gunslinging rat sitting in his kitchen floor. It's like Rocket Raccoon's smaller cousin.
Oh, dirty ratty.
Only wearing a Stetson. Possibly an eye patch.
Anyway, leaving the gunslinging rat to one side.
Missile Mouse. His name would be Missile Mouse.
This stuff writes itself.
Anyway, leaving that to one side, let's crack on with a bit of news.
Wait, but before the news, important news.
Important what?
This week on Inhumans Watch, Inhumans still looks really bad.
Oh, yeah, the CG hair, which, God.
Was it CG? Or was it just a stagehand off to one side with some fishing wire?
It might have been, because that first bit where the hair just kind of flares a little bit, I thought, that looks weird.
That first segment of that clip, it looks like someone's switched on one of those wind machines and then switched it off again really quickly, but the hair hasn't moved back into position.
Yes.
I think it's just magnets hidden in the wig.
No, you know those hairspray adverts from like the 90s?
Yeah. Is she or isn't she? I'm afraid she is.
Yes, absolutely.
Medusa clearly went to L'Oreal and found out she wasn't worth it.
But the rest of it, though, was just awful, awful, awful CG.
Hey, that's not fair. I'll have you know that the makeup for Triton is horrible, horrible practical effects.
So, the rumour mill says that this is going to be the most expensive TV series ever. We've got to ask, where's the money being spent?
I mean, are we talking expensive as in money, or expensive as in the cost of human life?
The collateral damage. The careers that have been left in its way.
Exactly.
I think at like the end of the series, we cut to the writer's room and the head writer is just like sat upon a throne of skulls.
It turns out he's the big bad for season one.
Black Bolt versus the head writer.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, he is the biggest threat to the Inhumans' well-being.
Yes.
He threatens to end their continued survival.
But I think it's quite curious that we're getting this Inhumans TV series and there's also an Inhumans movie in the work. Well, I mean, apart from the sort of Disney XD cartoons and stuff like that, they don't do that with any other show.
I'm not sure. I feel like it's more than likely that the movie has become the TV show.
Yeah, I think that's the case as well. I think that the movie is... I wouldn't put any money on seeing an Inhumans movie anytime in the near future, and hopefully not anytime in the far future as well.
Although Marvel being Marvel, I still feel like they're stubborn enough to just go, nope, nope, that Inhumans movie is coming at some point.
Look, I...
2011.
I want a... which one was Marvel again? Was it Man-Thing or Swamp Thing? It was Man-Thing, wasn't it?
Yep, they had the giant-sized Man-Thing.
The tear-stained final issue. Yeah, I remember now. But I would much rather see a Man-Thing movie before I see an Inhumans movie.
I mean, you've got Pornhub for that.
Yeah, don't do a search on Man-Thing.
No.
Really sad for, like, the one person who's made a really accurate, lovingly created Man-Thing fan film.
Inhumans.
So that's Inhumans Watch.
Yeah, Inhumans Watch is over and done with.
Tune in next week for another gripping episode.
Oh, no. Moving on to DC Watch, and what strange thing has DC done this week? And DC have announced that their new character for Legends of Tomorrow, Isis, was purposefully made a Muslim superhero in response to Donald Trump.
Yeah, Donald Trump and all those comments he's made about how what the world really needs is a more diverse range of superheroes. He's just sick of both the lack of female and Muslim representation in comics and TV. And by golly, he's going to fix it. Which I believe is an exact quote.
And if not, it probably will be by the end of the day.
Either that or someone in his press office will be fired.
Now that I've said that, does that officially mean we've joined the fake news?
Have you listened to some of the stories we've covered in recent weeks?
Yes.
ship sailed a long time ago.
We do the Geek Show as well. There are stories on there that are just kind of, nah, that can't be real. But it is. But it can't be. But it is. Now I'm depressed. I've lost faith in humanity.
So?
I'm just curious as to why DC's taken this long to actually have a Muslim superhero. Marvel put forward Ms. Marvel.
I mean, they probably do have, like, at least a Muslim superhero banging about somewhere.
Yeah, but, you know, where?
We covered the fact that Isis was going to be in Legends of Tomorrow probably a couple of months back.
Yeah, and Isis has...
And Isis herself has been around since the 70s. So maybe they've purposefully made this portrayal of her Muslim as a response to Trump, but it's another one of these knee-jerk decisions to diversify a character just for diversification's sake. And at the end of the day, Isis is a pre-existing character. Are we actually getting a Muslim superhero, or are we just getting a Muslim cast into a role that no one else is inhabiting at the moment?
Well, I think it's more the latter than the former, because if the image on this story is anything to go by, then that's definitely not a female Muslim superhero.
And yet there's a quote there from the actress that's sort of saying, oh, it was, you know.
Yeah.
It's something that I can identify with, and Guggenheim's come out and said that it was inspired by some experiences of a family member who's a Muslim and stuff like that. And I'm thinking, yeah, but, you know, we're talking about a faith that has got its own mythologies, got its own folklore. Pick something out of that.
Yeah.
Turn a hero out of that.
Well, this is the comment I made when we first started talking about Isis being, you know...
Ooh, but... Then again, if you do that, then don't you run into the problem of a Muslim superhero who being Muslim is like their entire thing?
Well, kind of you do, but then surely...
Reading Ms. Marvel, I like the way that Marvel have handled Ms. Marvel as a character, you know, with her being from a Muslim family and they're practicing Muslims as well. But I like the way they've handled it in not just in terms of the costume. And
that's what I mean. It's a big part of her character.
Yeah, but it's
not the be-all and end-all.
Exactly. And if DC have approached it in that way, then great, you know.
But I just feel that, you know, and I think I've said this before, if you're raised in a particular faith or a particular background, your reaction to the world around you, whether you are just an ordinary Joe going around your daily routine, or whether you're a spandex-clad superhero fighting crime on a global level, your motivations, your beliefs, your drive to do that is going to be flavoured by that belief system or that background.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I pointed out a while ago is the fact that Isis is an Egyptian goddess and, well, you know, Muslims believe in one god. And Isis isn't that one god.
No.
Yeah, I can see that being a little bit problematic.
You know. And the other thing is that Isis, and again, it was this fascination with helmets and amulets. Isis tends to possess through an amulet. So it doesn't actually make any difference what the person is who gets possessed by the spirit of Isis. They become Isis. Whether they're Muslim, Jewish, atheist, or whatever they are,
I know
they're going to become Isis.
There's also the obvious and more real-world connotation. Oh, look, it's Isis and it's Muslim.
Yes.
I'm going to say something which might be a bit controversial.
That's unlike you.
But possibly Mark Guggenheim and the Legends of Tomorrow team haven't entirely thought out the ramifications of this knee-jerk response.
I would say that's not very controversial. It's probably more accurate.
And also, let's be honest, if we look at Rip Hunter and his East End Cockney background story, they've not been great at sympathetically talking about ethnic minorities, have they?
I'll have you know, the East End is not an ethnic minority. They have their own TV show, after all.
Yes, but it's just filled with just their own kind. There's no integration there.
It's true. It is very tribal.
Well, there goes another demographic.
Yeah.
Bye, East End audience. I just want to reaffirm that the people of Japan are all incredibly lovely, and we are all made better for their listening to the show. Please love us. Please don't leave. We need you.
We love all our listeners. I'm not entirely sure that there is a Venn diagram of EastEnders viewers and our listeners.
I'm just of the opinion that the Japanese audience is just waiting for us to talk about manga again at some point and then just laugh at our ignorance.
Or maybe they're thinking, what we like about this show is the fact that they leave manga well alone, unlike other Westerners.
No, we don't. We finally get to see Zazy Beetz. I still can't believe that's her name, but Zazy Beetz Domino for Deadpool 2. What do you guys think?
Well, I think
I would have preferred it if her superhero codename had just been Zazy Beetz.
See, yeah, it's a much better name, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I would have liked it if the shot of her looked almost but not quite entirely like Domino, rather than, as it does, almost but not entirely unlike Domino.
I don't know, she's got the thing over her left eye that Domino has. Apparently that's close enough.
I don't know. When I do a search for Domino, all I get is pizza offers. But there you go.
You're looking in the wrong place.
It's Google. It's the only place. Maybe I should have put Marvel to specify.
No, because then you're going to get something like Marvel at Domino's Pizza.
Also, other pizza restaurants are available and are probably better than Domino's.
Yes. Yes, they are.
Unless you want to sponsor us, Domino's, then you're the best.
And by sponsor, we mean send free.
Oh, that is money off free pizza.
I don't know.
It is a tough question, though.
I'm still not buying it.
What, the Domino's pizza?
No. Well, definitely no. But, yeah, no, no.
Are we still talking about Domino the character, or are you just trying to decide whether you want pizza or not?
No, I definitely know I don't want pizza.
Right, okay.
Right, okay. But no, looking at, you know, I'll do my usual. I'll see what it's like, but, you know.
Do you know what I think it might be? I think it might be the fact that Deadpool and the Deadpool movies look so much like the comic book Deadpool that it's now weird when we've got a character who looks kind of a bit like their comic character, but not really.
Ah, yeah, because they did the CG Colossus, didn't they? But they made the effort to actually make CG Colossus look like
Colossus. Yeah, but it looked like Colossus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I get what you mean. Ah, you never know, she might actually turn out to be really good as Domino.
Yeah, like, to be fair, I think she
I'm not
going to
prejudge it until I've seen her in action.
Yeah.
It's just as a first impression, she doesn't look that much like Domino.
That's fair enough.
I still trust Deadpool 2 to be good, though.
Yeah.
Oh, also, speaking of things that would be good, I got very sad by some not news.
Oh?
Because you know how Fox are promising slash threatening to make a Doctor Doom movie?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who said would be really interested in the role and who will probably never, ever be cast as it?
Vince Cable.
No.
Vince Cable is playing Cable.
Get it? Because they have the same last name.
Ouch.
That's a punchline even you can't kill, Rob.
No. It's just...
Dead on arrival.
It's just when Andrew starts ripping into other people, I'm just glad I'm not the target.
But you so often are.
That's why I'm glad I'm not the target.
I think it's kind of like the Eye of Sauron. I'm just drawn towards terrible punchlines.
Yes. Anyway, Andrew, what were you saying? Who is it?
Yeah, Mads Mikkelsen. Mads Mikkelsen wants to be Doctor Doom, and that would be the most perfect thing ever. That's not going to happen, and life isn't worth living anymore.
You see, I'm not sure it would be that perfect.
I think it would be.
How dare you, it's Mads Mikkelsen. He's perfect in everything.
But this is the thing. I think part of the appeal of Mads Mikkelsen is the fact that he looks the way he looks.
Oh, man, that's true. There'll be an entire film of not being able to see Mads Mikkelsen's face.
But hearing his voice, Andrew.
Oh, it's a double-edged sword is what it is. Like, okay, I know how we fix it. It's Mads Mikkelsen playing Doctor Doom, but Doctor Doom who has, like, a photo of Mads Mikkelsen's face sellotaped over his mask.
What, as some kind of stealth device?
Yes.
Yes.
I will disguise myself.
Yes, it's just like Ocean's 12, where Mads Mikkelsen as Doctor Doom has to infiltrate a party pretending to be Mads Mikkelsen.
Okay, I think you just went full Inception on me. I lost you at the left turn.
That was a bizarre moment.
On that bizarre moment, shall we take a break?
Yes, please.
And then Mads Mikkelsen can team up with Missile Mouse.
Oh, because they're both double M, aren't they?
Yes, yes, they are.
You do realise that now means we've sold Missile Mouse to Marvel?
Yes.
No, think if I we sold him to Fox.
Oh, yeah. Ah, but Marvel will publish a comic spin-off, surely.
Well, Mighty Mouse has got a comic book series now.
No, Missile Mouse is a Fox original property, along with the rest of the Protectors of the Universe. Space Lord, Drux the Devastator, Gram, and Gammy.
Hello, do you like films? Well, wow, that's good. We're over the first hurdle. If you like films and you also like podcasts, you should probably check out the Geek Show's only dedicated movie podcast, Cinema Eclectica. Well staffed with a trained array of helper monkeys, we review all of the latest films every week and do it reasonably well.
You've tuned in, now you're going to get turned on to the Geek Show. I'm Quentin Flynn. People know me as Axel, who says, got it memorized, you should. The Geek Show, it rocks.
The Geek Show is the largest independent podcast network out there. And to be independent, we need a little bit of help every now and again. So if you want something to show your love of The Geek Show, head over to thegeekshow.co.uk, click on the shop, and buy some of our lovely wares.
Welcome back, and now it's time for comics, and we're going to kick things off with Mick.
Indeed. And this week I've got the Justice League of America because I thought it was time for me to cut my teeth on a DC review. And this one's called Power and Glory and is a collection by Brian Hitch, Daniel Enriquez and Alex Sinclair. And the stakes are high, let me tell you, because to save the future, the Justice League must face a god. That is the tagline right there.
Okay.
Not just any god.
Haven't they faced gods before?
Ah, they may have faced.
It really depends on the god. I mean, if it's like Dionysus, Greek god of wine, that's less impressive.
This is a good point.
Well, let me tell you, this is the Kryptonian god, Ra'u.
And did you say Ra'u or Ra'ul?
Ra'u. R-A-O, Ra'u.
I more enjoyed that brief moment of Rob's confusion where for a second the Kryptonian god was Ra'u Julia.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
So, now the thing is, I'm not sure where this sits in DC's continuity, whether it's New 52, it has no New 52 logo on it, Rebirth, it's not got a Rebirth logo on it, or Convergence, it's not got a Convergence logo on it. So, there's lots of mentions of a forthcoming crisis, so Lord alone knows where it sits. However, the makeup of the Justice League is Hal Jordan's Green Lantern, Aquaman, Superman, Batman, Cyborg, and The Flash, and Wonder Woman.
I think there must be a relatively new one then.
Yeah.
I think it wasn't that long ago that Cyborg joined the Justice League. I think that was after the New 52.
I mean, it says it collects Justice League of America's number 1-4 and 6-10, but it doesn't tell you which decades number 1-4 and 6-10, or indeed which months number 1-4. But anyway, it's a story in which Superman dies.
What again?
Sorry. It's another story in which Superman dies. Fortunately, in this one, it's at the beginning. So it's not really a spoiler. And he does die a lot. What, repeatedly.
Just in this one series?
Listen, Tom Cruise, if you want to live, die, repeat, you read this graphic novel and see how Superman does it. That's how you live, die, repeat.
Is he like Rory from Doctor Who, where he just dies and dies and dies again?
Yeah, pretty much. So, basically, Superman dies, and then Superman goes to visit a corporation that claim to know stuff, and they keep finding these dying Supermen and trying to get them into their offices. They're called the Infinity Corporation, and they're monitoring, using some special magical stones, various timelines, and they're trying to get to a point where Superman doesn't die. They're trying to find a surviving Superman from this moment in time to find out what happened to cause Superman to die, and it's not happening. Meanwhile, they've also sent invites to all the secret identities of the rest of the Justice League, inviting them to a power plant, where they find that the senders of the invite have unleashed Parasite, who absorbs all the energy from all the superheroes.
Wait a minute. Can I just backtrack a sec?
Yeah.
Send invites to all the Justice League's secret identity.
Yes.
Cyborg has a secret identity.
No.
Well.
Half his face is robot.
Yes. But,
hello, I'm Simon Borg, ordinary half-robot teenager.
Right.
The mysterious half-robot superhero Cyborg is.
The point is that the invitation is addressed to Victor Stone, not to Cyborg. Batman's is addressed.
I think you're fine. Simon Borg is his real name.
Yes. His elder brother was Bjorn.
Oh, who let Rob out?
You guys left the fence open. Now I'm just calmly wandering around the roads.
Yeah. If it hasn't got a gate, that is not an open fence. That's a hole you made in it.
It's fine. I'll gently herd Rob back inside. You continue, Mick.
Okay. So the whole point is that they're trying to change events to avoid this calamity crisis that they've seen. And meanwhile, whilst all this is happening, there's a colossal discharge of energy, and Wonder Woman ends up thrown to Olympus, where she discovers a broken Olympus that the gods have abandoned, and she is now the Queen of Olympus, which is a bit pointless because there's no one there. So she's the queen of a lot of floating rock, basically. So she remakes Olympus in her own particular style. She basically does a makeover on Olympus. Flash and Green Lantern, they get thrown to the planet Krypton some 250,000 years ago, but Flash is only there briefly because he ended up back on Earth. And then Batman sort of sulks a lot and is moody
and
pragmatic. Aquaman goes off to Atlantis. And meanwhile, in the sky, a cathedral appears, a big spaceship that's called the Cathedral. And in it is Rao, who plucks Superman from an almost certain death at the hands of having his powers absorbed by Parasite, and explains who he is. And because it's the god of Krypton, Superman goes, "I'll be your emissary to this adopted planet of mine." And this is where we find out what Rao's evil plan is. Rao's evil plan is to spread peace, love, happiness across the planet Earth.
It's
the Justice League's It's the Justice League's mission to stop him, the Blighter.
This doesn't sound like it was very well written.
Well, yeah. It's one of those things where You know, sometimes you sit there and you think, what if this happened to Superman? And then you think, what if this happened to Batman? And then you think, what if this happened to Aquaman? And then you think, yeah, but it's a ridiculous idea, so no one will ever do it. Well, they've taken all those ridiculous ideas and put them into one story. There's time travel. There's a god. Rao uses a kind of mental control to make you worship him. Puts a lot of the churches, the organized churches on Earth, out of business, because obviously there's no need for their good charity works, because he's seeing people raise money and collect food for starving people in Africa. He just turns up in Africa and turns it into a verdant green land with lots of vegetation and roaming beasts so that they can become self-sufficient.
God, but it doesn't matter. Psychopath, will it ever end?
I know.
This is starting to sound more like what DC have done typically with the Justice League, in that they're more like a bunch of whiny teenagers who don't like people telling them what to do. And so they turn around and say, you can't tell me what to do. You're not my real dad, or you're not my real mum.
And this is basically how this plot unfolds. Batman is the whiniest of whiny teenagers and goes, no, I'm not doing it.
No, if Rao achieves world peace, I might actually have to get some help for my deep psychological issues.
Yeah. I mean, Batman's main issue with it is that there's no need for hospitals anymore. No one's dying. All injuries get healed. Batman's problem with that is, of course, that's giving a second chance to hardened criminals.
Well, surely if they're getting a second chance, I mean, is he worried about the negative second chance that they're getting?
He's worried about the fact that, you know, you're talking about serial killers and rapists and sex offenders are being given the ability to go out on the streets and do that stuff again.
Yeah, but a god who can basically turn the desert into a lush, verdant pasture filled with lots of things to eat can easily remove that sort of element from society and put them somewhere else.
Yeah, and that's kind of where it goes, though.
Also, the Joker break out of Arkham Asylum every other week anyway?
Yeah.
Well, he does, yeah. Not giving him a second chance, that's him taking it.
No, I actually think that he's actually got a key. I think he's got his own key, and he just says, I'm going out now, guys. And they're all like, all right, okay, make sure you're back before before next Wednesday.
I think at some point someone's going to write a story where it turns out that actually the Joker is the descendant of the guy who founded Arkham Asylum, and it's actually his family pile.
Probably. It's probably going to happen. You know, there's going to be something like that at some point.
He's going to know where all the priest holes are that he can use to get out. Yeah. But back to Power and Glory. It kind of works as a story, and it kind of works as a parable about free will and control and stuff. But it gets there in a really messy way, and there are whole sections where you're in the present one minute, you're in the future another. There's not enough variation to tell you exactly where it is. And it finishes up with, like, one of the biggest resets in history. So, in actual fact, you read all, 160, 170 pages, and it turns out that none of it really happens.
So none of it mattered at all?
No. So, really big stakes that ultimately didn't matter.
Well, that sounds like a typical DC story.
Yeah, so the artwork is decent. There's some nice variant covers collected in it, some of which are more relevant than others. Like, I'm not entirely sure why there's a Teen Titans Go variant, but there is.
God.
There's a DC Bombshells variant cover, which is quite nice. But it's indicative of the same problems that Suicide Squad and Batman vs. Superman had in the movies. It's too much fan stuff going on. I mean, really, who cares about Rao? You know, he died with Krypton. Let's be honest.
He died for their sins.
And there's also other little bits and pieces that are weird, like Cyborg's dad helps develop some flying robots that the Justice League and some drone robots in the same ilk. And bearing in mind that they've got something like, the typical sort of 24 hours to save the world. In 24 hours, not only do they manage to build these machines, but they also manage to specifically design a bat-shaped one for Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
And it's all that kind of stuff that kind of makes it fall apart.
Yeah, it sounds like typical DC.
Yeah. Well, like I say, some of the panels are really nice. It's a pretty book.
That's on the scale of me saying the best thing about this story is that the plot is linear.
Yeah. Well, the plot on this is anything but linear. The loyalties of the JLA are tested. There's also the guy who runs the Infinity Corporation. There's something about him that never fully gets resolved. He obviously knows stuff that he's not letting on.
Is it Thanos?
Whether that's a gateway to a future story or not, I don't know. But
is it Thanos? And are these stones that they use Infinity Stones?
No, there are two lots of stones. There are the future stones, and there are the stones of life. And they've been trying to talk to each other. And it's the stones of life that have been giving Rao his power. The dark side to Rao is that all this good stuff that he does, he then takes a day of your life to feed his own power. And that's why he's managed to survive the death of Krypton, because he's been off conquering billions of worlds.
Okay.
In life powers. This will place it in the continuity. The variant cover for Justice League of America number 9 was a Batman versus Superman variant cover.
Okay, so we've got an idea from when it's from.
Yeah.
Right. Shall we move on to Andrew?
Please.
Yeah, go on then. So, I have been reading Fool Killer, which is by Max Bemis, with art by... Oh no, this was a horrible mistake. By Dalibor Talajic, and that's exactly how you pronounce it. So I covered the first issue of this a while ago, and now the collected edition is out. It focuses on a man called Greg Salinger, who used to and kind of still is a vigilante named Fool Killer, but is also a trained psychotherapist. And his whole gig is that kind of analyzes wannabe villains and basically decides if they're redeemable, he'll keep treating them. If not, he'll off them.
It's a harsh treatment regime.
It is. It is very much the... Nope, can't think of the name of the super tough fitness regime. I'm just not having a good time of it.
The super tough fitness regime?
Insanity.
Yeah, that was it.
No, there's like a one.
What, boxer size? Or something like
that? No, it's like the Iron Man.
Oh,
all right. Yeah. Tough Mudder.
Anyway, it's very much that of psychotherapy, which would have been a hilarious joke like 5 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. So, don't worry about it. Rob would have just killed the punchline.
There's no guarantee of that.
Oh, there is.
But yeah, it's this kind of really weird sort of black comedy-esque, but also very sort of very meta-type book. Like, there's a lot of stuff about how kind of a lot of people in comics are crazy because people see that as like an endearing character trait, and so they never get any sort of professional help. But then there's also a bit where he gets a client called the... Oh, man, this is going to be like a hard... It's a very good joke, but it's hard to explain. He's basically the %SQE-King and has a symbol of, like, a steaming turd on his chest.
Okay.
But there's a bit where he asks... Oh, sorry, I think I'm mishearing you. Can you spell that for me? He says, yep, it's %%SQE. And then we get his origin story, which is that one time when Fing Fang Foom attacked New York City, he took a gigantic dump on the guy's family and killed them all.
And is that... Are we talking literally?
Yep, literally.
Oh, God.
Hey, even space dragons need to poop.
Well,
I think we have
to go in the woods with the bears.
Apparently not.
Right.
And then it's also got what is possibly like one of my favourite single issues of a comic, which is issue 4, when Deadpool shows up, and they actually do like a good Deadpool appearance.
Oh.
Because they use it as an excuse to just get ridiculously meta. Like, the whole thing is that Deadpool feels like he's under a lot of pressure, because back in the good old days, no one counted on him for anything. He could just run around doing what he likes. But now he feels like there's suddenly all this attention on him, and this he's got to do like five or six different things in a month, and it's a joke about how Deadpool is now like the most popular Marvel character.
See, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's lots of fun nods and winks. But I also feel like that's kind of a downside for it as well, because basically you reach a point where you realise, oh, this is where Max Bemis was told, by the way, this is only a 5-issue miniseries, you need to start wrapping things up. And it gets very dense, like to the point that there's also a lot of stuff that it just gets assumed you'll know about. Like another character called Fool Killer, who was apparently a guy Greg convinced to be a vigilante back in the day. He shows up and they have a bit of a fight, and you're kind of just expected to know who this character is. Like, they've got the classic bit where, like, you kind of see sort of his shoes, and gradually the panels pan up to the big reveal that, hey, it's this guy. You know who this guy is, right? You're really big Fool Killer fans, because everyone's a big Fool Killer fan, right? Right, guys? Right?
Yeah, got all of them.
Yes, I've been following Fool Killer for years.
Exactly, so that's why we won't put... Well, put a very vague explanation as to who the hell this character is. Yeah, and just that the plot also feels, like, very rushed. Because, like, over the course of 5 issues, we go from kind of Greg is a psychiatrist, but also he starts killing the patients he doesn't like. But then, surprise, it turns out this was all a plot by, like, an ex-SHIELD agent to turn Greg into his personal hitman. But no, now all that's pushed aside because the other Fool Killer's back for a revenge plot. And then Deadpool. And then all of that gets wiped away again because it turns out this whole thing was also an even bigger plot by the Hood to hire Greg as his psychiatrist to help him become a more effective supervillain.
See, this is starting to sound more like Dexter meets Analyze This meets any random superhero type movie.
Actually, they specifically mention Analyze This.
Do they?
Yeah, I think there's a bit where the Hood's saying, like, think about it, it's genius, a criminal who uses a psychiatrist to make himself better. No one's ever done that before, except for, like, an Analyze This. And its sequel, Analyze That.
Okay, so...
It's good. I feel like it would have been better if it had more time to breathe, but that's... I can probably, like, spend hours counting all the Marvel series that have suffered from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just that point at which Marvel have gone, actually, we're axing this. Wrap it all up in 2 issues.
Yeah.
Of which at least one will be part of a crossover event.
Probably. Speaking
of... Actually, that's a good point. None of these, like, feature into any big Marvel event.
Oh, that's a rarity.
Yeah. Which is annoying, because it almost makes it, like, a great thing to read, except that you do have to be, like, very familiar with lots of minute details of Marvel lore to understand half the things going on.
Hmm.
Like, heck, probably a lot of people don't even know who the Hood is anymore.
This is true.
No, I was thinking, what, the bad guy from Thunderbirds?
Sadly, no. He was basically, like, some big supervillain from a while ago.
Are we talking about Arrow's original name before they called him Arrow? In the TV series, wasn't that what they called him first? Yeah. The Hood.
Yeah. The Hood.
No, this is actually Evil Cuba Gooding Jr. See, I joke about this book being too obscure and then make a Boys in the Hood reference.
Exactly.
Well, I never said I wasn't a hypocrite.
Anyway.
So, yeah, ultimately, I would say it's a good series. Just you probably have to get over the fact that some things are going to go over your head.
That's fair enough. I mean, it's comic books. Something's going to go over someone's head at some point.
Hey, when you've had a dry patch as long as mine, most things go over your head in comic books.
Yours wasn't so much a dry patch as a drought.
It was more like a desert.
Anyway, speaking of room to breathe, as you said, someone else who could do with a bit of room to breathe is Mark Millar.
Someone just needs to give him some nap time pills.
Yeah, well, or take his pencils away or something. Something, anything. Just give him a break, give him a holiday. Mark Millar and Stuart Immonen have put their heads together and come up with a new series. We've got the volume one of Empress, which is, it's kind of like a reverse Saga. You know how in Saga...
Considering the way Saga, literally the first panel is...
Yeah, well, this
that's,
is...
That's a horrifying thought.
Yeah, this isn't like Saga and the Red Wife episode backwards meeting in the middle. It's nothing like that at all when I say reverse Saga. I mean, just in terms of the actual story itself, it's nowhere near as explicit as Saga. It's set 65 million years ago, and it starts off with the Emperor, the Intergalactic Emperor, Morax, and he has conquered the galaxy. He's brought peace and harmony through subjugation by force and fear. He's basically like the Jurassic era Darth Vader type character.
Okay, that's interesting. So this is a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Not
and an evil empire has taken over the galaxy.
Not quite. See, Morax is emperor, and he got married. Before he became emperor, he was something more like a mercenary, a very famous one. And he got married to a woman who was, she was basically just subbing in for one of her friends for a night as a waitress. That woman's name was Emporia, and she became his wife and ultimately the empress. But she's realized that Morax is basically a crazy so-and-so, and so with her trusted guard, Dane Havelock, she is going to escape from Morax, and she's going to take their kids as well.
You're right, I was wrong. This is not Star Wars.
No,
this is not. The Human League's Don't You Want Me.
Yeah. And so Emporia and Dane, they take the three kids, the eldest daughter, Ayn, the eldest son, Adam, who is kind of a genius with machinery, and the youngest son, who's still a toddler, called Puck. And so they go on the run, the five of them, and they're running across the galaxy. Emporia Morax had an agreement that anything from her life before she met Morax, nobody would ever be talking about it. All details, all records would be wiped from existence. And so Morax doesn't actually know that Emporia has a sister. And so Emporia is on the run to try and get to her sister and hopefully to have some safety. But obviously, that doesn't work out. It's weird because there's elements of Lost in Space in this, because they have this teleporting, artificially intelligent robot type thing that they call Ship that can teleport to any location that it can see. And so it can see, you know, it's got loads of places stored in its memory banks and it can see those places, so it can teleport to them. And distance doesn't seem to be that much of an object for the most part. It can jump from one planet to another. But it's weird because Ship, because of that, this whole thing takes on a bit of the Lost in Space vibe, where they just in a ship, all of them together, and then all of a sudden they go, Ship, go, and the ship will teleport and they'll appear somewhere else. They go through loads of different worlds, loads of different cultures, and eventually they meet Emporia's sister, only for things to happen. And Ayn, who has been unhappy with leaving her dad, has finally got sick of the situation, calls her dad, only for her mum's past to come to the fore, when her mum and dad finally have an argument, as in a proper, full-on, physical, punchy-punchy argument, which ends in her mum beating the crap out of her dad and killing them.
That's domestic abuse, that is.
No, it's domestic murder. She basically, she snaps his neck. She snaps his neck. See, the thing is, Emporia's...
She's an even bigger monster than Rao.
Yeah, Emporia is, her history, because it got wiped, right, because Morax didn't want to know about her past, he doesn't know anything about what she was before. All he knows is for that one night she was working as a waitress in a cocktail bar. It really is, Don't You Want Me, Baby, isn't it? So, I'll be honest, I mean, this is book one, and they've queued it up for book two to deal with the past, the secret history of Dane Havelock. I'm curious where Miller's going with this, because some of his stuff has been good, some of his stuff has not been as good. You know, when he's on his game, he's great. When he's not on his game, he's like everybody else, just a normal person trying to write stories and failing. So I am curious. He's got me by the interest, at least.
Well, that's good of him.
Yeah.
Actually, we say that. I feel like Mark Miller's slowed down recently.
He has. I mean, I've got to say, Stuart Immonen's artwork is actually quite nice. You know, it's...
just draw a nice comic.
The characters have a nice variety to them. You know, it's not the typical kind of superhero, everyone big, bulky, muscular sort of thing. I mean,
yes, I know him. He's the one who did the art for Next Wave.
Yeah. One of the characters in this is like Cosmic Gary Coleman. He fought in the One Day War.
Right then.
Okay.
Anyway, back to you, Mick.
Back to me. For review time. Some of you may have noticed that just recently a film has launched in cinemas called Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. So I've got volume two of the complete collection, which features three stories, The Land Without Stars, Welcome to Al-Flolol, and Birds of the Master. And in these, we follow our spatiotemporal agents, Valerian and Loreline, to a variety of planets. And possibly the most interesting one is The Land Without Stars, which takes on the idea of the War of the Sexes.
Okay.
And how.
Well, is this like a literal war?
This is a literal war. So, basically, there's a asteroid heading towards a colony, and Loreline and Valerian are sent off on a mission to try and avert disaster on this colony. And they find themselves in a hollow world. The asteroid turns out to be a world inside. And so the sun on this world is actually the core of the asteroid. And it's, you've got some nomadic creatures, humanoid creatures, that collect and harvest these explosive plants and sell them to both sides involved in this war. And one side is a city ruled exclusively by warrior women.
Okay.
And the other side is a city populated almost entirely by quite effete, effeminate men who have no interest in fighting other than to ward off the attacks of the women. And the women are capturing men to fight in their armies. These, both the nomads, the men in one city and the women in the other city, are completely unaware of anything outside of their planet. And in order to try and control the situation, Loreline and Valerian split up, and Loreline goes off to the city of the men, and Valerian goes off to the city of the women, and he gets captured and made to fight in the female armies, and Loreline goes off to be a harem girl. And this is one of the many times where a panel looks exactly like a cell from the original Star Wars trilogy, as we see Loreline held captive in a gold bikini.
Ah.
This story is from 1972, I should point out. So basically they get involved in this War of the Sexes, and Valerian manages to prove himself in battle. Loreline wins the favour of the leader of the male city, and they manage to negotiate a peace and avert the disaster. But it's just the way that it sort of shows that battle of the sexes without portraying it being the men who are the dominant warlike creatures. It's the women who've got that sort of we must attack mentality.
It's funny because the way you've described it, it reminded me of an episode of Rick and Morty, and it also reminded me of an episode of Star Trek Voyager, where you had like the men on one side and the women on the other, and they were basically fighting some strange war or something like that.
Yeah.
I think it was Voyager anyway.
I don't remember the Rick and Morty episode.
Well, everyone remembers the Rick and Morty episode because it starts off with Rick buying Morty that sex robot.
Who he has a son with.
The thing that gets you with, and obviously I've kind of become the resident Valerian expert, the thing that gets you is because of the primitive printing techniques, you've got these sort of limited colour palettes, but the epic scale of the final battle between the men and the women is just gorgeous to look at, and you get that real sense of an epic battle as these two mighty empires fight against each other. Welcome to Al-Flolol is another interesting story. There's a planet called Technorog that has been colonized by humans, and it's like the resource planet. So it's been covered in mines and logging operations and food production and hydroponic stations, etc. And it's really productive, and it provides pretty much all the minerals and resources that are used by the Terran Empire to power its spaceships, feed its colonies, etc. And as Valerian and Loreline are doing a tour of the colonies, and Valerian is trying out some of the produce, they fly into a ship. They have a collision.
Just a head-on collision in space?
Yes.
Which is pretty big.
Yeah.
and has lots of room to move, maneuver.
I should point out that Valerian is slightly inebriated.
He's drunk driving?
He's drunk driving in space. And when you're drunk, in control of a spaceship, space ain't that big.
What's wrong with the plants in the Valerian story? You had like a bomb plant and now you've got an alcohol plant.
No. The planet doesn't produce alcohol. Or the plants don't produce alcohol in and of themselves. In much the same way that potatoes, when you pull them out of the ground, are filled with poutine.
True. So
what happens is that the guys at the various hydroponics plants experiment a little bit and say, I've been knocking this up off the books. Do you want to have a taste?
Okay.
So they crash into this, what looks like an organic piece of matter in space. Turns out it's actually a spaceship. And what it is they're filled with creatures for whom Technorog is their homeworld. And they're an extremely long-lived species. They've been off in what is an effective fortnight's holiday for them, but for us is like thousands and thousands of years. And now they're on their way back, and they've basically come home to find that humans are squatting on their planet. And not only are they squatting, but they've made a right mess of it.
Yeah, they haven't wiped the backsides. Dragging the backsides all over the carpet.
They've built coal mines on top of sacred burial sites and all the rest of it. And so you get this sort of Avatar-style battle between natives. But it's not really a battle. It's a sort of aggressive negotiation on the part of the Terrans over whether or not they're going to allow these people to return back to their home and stuff.
Hang on.
And then they start putting them to work. And
Whoa. Isn't this the plot of The Phantom Menace?
Yes. Can I point you to the direction of 1972?
Wow, it's really impressive that they ripped it off before it was even invented then.
Yeah. I believe the first time I covered Valerian, we mentioned how, let's be kind, how influenced George Lucas may have been by
When you say he was under the influence, had he been eaten some of those?
I think he'd been to the planet of Technorog, yes.
And accidentally crashes spaceship.
Yeah. So basically, we go through a series of diplomatic incidents where, first of all, they try to put these returning aliens into reservations. That doesn't work. There are riots because they've given them plots of land where they can't grow food. So because Valerian and Loreline are outraged, Loreline particularly is outraged at Valerian because he's doing his loyal, dutiful soldier bit and she's going, but this is hurting these people. Then because they're starving, because they've been given sort of infertile land, they're given food and that causes riots in the human colony because they're having to work for their food and suddenly these people who turned up from nowhere are getting given free food. So then they're put to work, but their ways are not our ways, so they're not used to the machines and all the rest of it, so that causes problems on the plants and that lowers productivity, so then there's another set of riots. But eventually they sort it all out. And then we come to the third and final story in this collection, which is Birds of the Master from 1973, which is a kind of weird psychological thing where this guy rules over this planet by controlling this swarm of birds that inject you with a venom, and the venom saps you of your free will.
Okay.
Hold on. Isn't this Power and Glory? JLA?
Yeah.
Anyway, Birds of the Master is different in its tone. Again, it's got some gorgeous panels in it. But the other thing is, it's the first one in the Valerian series where the final frame actually hints at a possible sequel.
Okay.
Because Valerian and Loreline, through their cunning and guile, managed to defeat the Master and eject said Master off to space, leaving the other people.
Leaving him to regenerate into John Sim.
And the last panel shows Valerian's ship with the Master squatting on top of it.
Okay.
So that could lead to other things. But again... It's three very different and very enjoyable stories.
I just have one question, right, just about the second story.
Yes.
Right. Valerian's ship and the ship of these people who'd been on holiday.
This ship that looks like a rock. It looks like a giant space rock.
in comparison to Valerian ship, it's pretty big, I'm assuming.
It's about the same size.
Oh, okay.
Maybe a little bigger. I did mention Valerian was inebriated.
Yeah. I'm just
it wasn't so much that he wasn't able to avoid it. It was just that his reflexes were slow and he didn't necessarily remember what all the buttons did at that particular time.
Okay.
And he had Loreline nagging him.
Okay. Anyway, Andrew.
Yep. I have been reading a manga, so it's time to beat that with the stick of ignorance.
Not so much in this case, I think, though.
Actually, no, because this is one of my specialist subjects. I'll take my first question now, John Humphreys. Mastermind.
I know. I wasn't going to go. Dun, 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 dun.
Thank you. That's all I wanted.
What, yeah, what we did do, though, is exhibit our ignorance of manga by not having any questions to ask you.
Well, it's a good thing I have words to say then.
Indeed. Because
this is H.P. Lovecraft's The Hound and Other Stories, adapted by... Oh, that's what I was going to ask.
Go Tanabe, is it?
Okay, it is Go, because it's like Gio. Yeah. Said Gi. That's not a letter. G-O-U.
No, Gi is clarified butter. They use it in Indian cooking.
Go Tanabe. And this is a collection of three of Lovecraft's short stories, The Temple, The Hound, and The Nameless City. And of them, I think The Temple is probably my favourite one. It's set on board a German U-boat. For his individual stories, World War One, but in this, it's been updated to World War II. Basically, the crew of the U-boat, they come across an almost abandoned ship with one dead guy on it, clutching onto some strange kind of idol. So they take that aboard, and slowly the crew start to go insane. Like, one of them starts praying to the idol. Others insist that, like, the dead guy is following them, swimming in the water, to drag them all into the depths. And eventually this causes a mutiny, and the captain kind of just ruthlessly executes his crew until he's the only one left. But in all the fighting, the ship is damaged and ends up sinking to the bottom of the ocean, where the captain comes across what he thinks must be Atlantis. It's kind of an abandoned undersea city, except surprise, because just as he's kind of sitting in the dark about to blow his own brains out, the city proves to not be so abandoned, as a bunch of lights come on, and the last panel is just the captain walking out in a submarine suit into the light.
I like that.
Yeah, I like it. It's your classic Lovecraft creepiness. But I just love, like, the extra element of, like, isolation paranoia that the U-boat adds to it.
Yeah, but I like the way it ends as well. You got that element of the unknown. You don't actually know what he's discovered.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of him, I think there's probably, like, one of my favourite moments in this. Is where basically, like, the guy who's praying to the idol turns to the captain and just says, like, no, it'll have no effect on you. You're too sane. Because wow. The captain is just nothing but a ruthless pragmatist. Because, like, he is the kind of cold-hearted monster. It's just like, no, it is our mission to serve the fatherland. Anyone who disobeys will get shot.
It's not really a sick burn, though, is it?
You're too sane.
That's much good. I like the idea. There's someone who's just too ruthlessly pragmatic to be affected by, like, crazy elder gods.
Oh, great. Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Yeah, and I love how, like, the art in this, because I know we don't usually get too technical on the art, but this first story, it's really heavily inked. So there's just, like, lots of huge spaces filled with nothing but inky blackness. And I think that's a really good effect of making it seem just really isolated. So, yeah, that's the first one. And after that, we've got The Hound, which is about a pair of, like, aristocratic grave robbers. It's like two super rich dudes who've got so bored with life that they've decided, like, robbing graves is the only thrill they can get. So they're doing that. They dig up an idol, which is, like, in the shape of a weird flying lion monster. And then they start hearing, like, just a sinister growling following them everywhere. And then one of them, in another great panel, one of them is just, like, walking down the street, and he just sees, like, a huge black mass with two giant glowing eyes. And his friend finds him just, like, torn to shreds. And then, see, classic Lovecraft, he goes a bit mental and shoots himself in the head.
Not one for your happy ending, was he, Lovecraft?
No, he wasn't.
I mean, the third one has kind of a happy ending.
Technically.
No one dies or is driven irreparably insane. Basically about...
I sense a but.
I mean, it's just a nice, happy story. about an adventurer who goes into like the Arabian desert, finds an abandoned city, finds it filled with like coffins and strange ancient architecture depicting a pre-human civilization who tortured and maimed like the early humans as they were dying out, and then finds that like the mysterious howling wind he heard is actually all the ghosts of the dead race screaming in hatred for humanity.
Wow.
And it just ends with this great line of, "In the clawing of the swirling currents, there seemed to abide a vindictive rage all the stronger because it was largely impotent."
Wow.
I think there's something like a bit poignant about how we've got all these Lovecraft monsters. It's like even looking at them will cause your brain to melt out your nose. And this is just about a bunch of ghosts who can't do anything. They're just stuck for the rest of eternity screaming in hatred.
Yeah, I like the idea of that. I've got some interesting information for you, Andrew.
Oh, do we?
Yes, about this, right? Because the Japanese name for this is Makan. And Gotanabe has actually done more than just this.
Ooh, is there a whole series?
There is Kyoki no San Miyaku Night, or Nite, which is At the Mountains of Madness.
Ooh.
Yeah, he also has done Isekai no Shikisai, which is The Color of Outer Space.
Ooh.
So, The Color Out of Space, I should say. And Yami ni Hao Mono, which is The Haunter of the Dark. All H.P. Lovecraft stories. All well, adapted for manga.
Dark Horse, get on it. Get these adapted. I want them.
I know you do. I just thought I'd make you aware of that.
Now I love Gotanabe even more. And just like as the final nail in the love coffin, he snuck an amazing reference into the second story. Because there's a bit where the two grave robbers are reading the Necronomicon, which is like a book that appears in Lovecraft's work, like all the ancient evil dark magic. Only it's like bound in human flesh. So it looks just like the Necronomicon from The Evil Dead.
Excellent.
Excellent. They ought to release that as a part work.
They probably would. You know, more like a journal, a diary.
Issue 1, only $1.99. Subsequent issues, Your Eternal Soul.
No. Can you imagine if it was like a diary? You know, a 16-year-old teenage girl's diary.
Dear diary. Today Jeremy was a real jerk to me, and also I want to devour the souls of the puny humans and bathe in their flesh blood.
Interesting you say bathe in their flesh blood, because I've been reading issues 1-4 of Redneck, which is from Image Comics. It's by Donny Cates, and the art's by Lisandro Esterin. Redneck is a bit of a strange beast. Ostensibly, it is set in East Texas in Sulphur Springs. It starts on Christmas Eve, and it's got a guy butchering a cow. You know, he's just sliced the neck of it. But then it cuts to just an older guy sitting on his porch on a rocking chair, drinking what looks to be a bottle of beer that has the word Blood Vice on it, and a girl who's drawing on the porch, and she seems to be able to read his mind. And then you realize that these are vampires. And what they've been doing is basically they've found themselves in Sulphur Springs and they basically just tried to stay away from the spotlight, out of trouble, out of sight, out of mind, keep your heads down, etc., etc. But the three young'uns, they want to go out. The three boys, although they are men now, but the three boys want to go out to town. The youngest one, called Slap, he's a scaredy cat, he doesn't want to go, but all three of them are vampires. So what could happen to them? What could possibly happen to them at all in this town? Their dad's saying, look, just don't kill anyone while you're in town, because they're vampires and, you know, vampires do kill. And
they can be a bit bitey.
I love the irony of the fact that when they're annoyed or angry, the vampires even say, Jesus Christ, Dad, will you just leave me alone?
And then immediately burst into flames.
See, it's just funny, that little irony. But yeah, this has actually got my attention because it's not your typical kind of vampire story. It's not about sexy vampires. It's about vampires who are, you know, they've basically tried to stay off the radar. They don't really want trouble. They're in a feud with a family that's been going on for decades. You know, they've been in a feud with a normal family, who the Landry family, I should say, who have basically, they've got a priest, the head priest in the town is now a Landry. And so the feud has been going on, and the Landrys know what this family is, right? They know that this family is vampires, but the Landrys don't bother them, and this family stays away from the Landrys. It's kind of an uneasy truce, but any little thing could set it off. What they don't know is that a simple trip to town to go to a strip joint is going to turn horribly, horribly wrong.
How could that possibly go wrong for three young vampires?
Well, the three young vampires aren't out to start trouble, they're just out to have fun. And it's not them who start trouble, it's the Landry family who starts trouble. And the Landry family, for a bunch who are supposed to be a respectable family, they've got a lot of lowlifes in there. You know, bikers, tattooed people, all sorts of other things like that. Anyway, Bartlett, who is, he's ostensibly part of their family, he has gone to town to get the lads and bring them home, make sure they don't run into trouble. But trouble comes to his doorstep when he tells them all to go home, but the boss Landry has turned up and he says something insulting. And after that, Bartlett wakes up on his porch with his hand catching fire because of the sun. He can't remember what's happened the night before, but his brother, JV, who's the lad's dad, says to him, "What the f*** did you do? Seriously, what the hell did you do in town?"
I like how you stopped yourself from swearing and then just did it anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'm quoting, so it's okay.
I don't think it is okay.
No.
Anyway.
Think of the children.
No, JV is really angry because something... JV's really angry because something's gone horribly wrong. He throws Bartlett out and says, "What did you do?" And there, hanging from the tree, is the youngest kid, Slap, burning in the daylight. He's obviously dead. And
cue wacky sitcom music.
Something's gone horribly wrong, and they don't know what it is. And now Bartlett needs to try and figure out what the hell's gone wrong, what the hell has happened, because there's a bunch of slaughtered cows around, and the Landry family is in a pretty bad state as well. Somebody's done a number on them, and so this war that's been brewing under the surface between the vampires and the Landry family is about to blow over the top. But what they don't realise is that the Landrys and the vampires have all been manipulated by somebody else. And that's the key thing. The young girl, the little girl who's also a vampire, she can read minds just like her grandpa can. And her grandpa is a proper old-school vampire monster. He wants to return to the old days when humans feared vampires and hid indoors and things like that, and vampires hunted wherever they wanted. And Bartlett and the rest, they don't want that because they know what it's like to be on the run, to be hunted and hated. And so you've got this clash of ideologies as well between, the older vampire who just dreams about power and control, and the more modern vampires, the more liberal vampires who, they just want to be left alone now. You know, they drink bottles of cow blood mixed with mixed with turpentine or something like that, or, I don't know, rocket fuel or whatever it is.
Why they have cows.
Yeah.
Surely you'd think they'd want some other animal, because vampires don't like steaks.
Hey!
I'm not even going to bother retorting to that.
Anyway, I have a question.
Yeah?
Is the feud with the Landrys related to any vampire-y activity in the past?
Yes. Well, no, but yes. See,
well, that's cleared that up.
Well, it's complicated. See, Bartlett used to be a soldier, and he basically deserted. But when he deserted, he stole the wrong horse. He stole the horse of the boss at the time, who was an old guy whose surname was Landry. And so they chased him for days. Bartlett made the mistake of going by a group of vampires who were also on the run and who were hungry, who ultimately chased him down. And that is how the feud between the vampires and the Landrys started, is because just a complete fluke, just a complete accident. But one of the female vampires, Bartlett was kind of in love with her, but when he realized that she was already in a relationship with the guy who was ultimately going to become his older brother, he just left and wandered the world, only to come back to find out the Landrys had basically killed her. So the hatred between the Landrys and the vampires is born deep, and it won't go away. But they still don't know, because the hatred is so strong that somebody else is manipulating everything they do and every way they act.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's a matter of finding out. And the little girl, because she can read minds, she's trying to read Bartlett's mind to find out what the hell happened that night and who killed Slap. And that's why it's got my attention. It's kind of a murder mystery wrapped up in, hillbilly feud, wrapped up in vampire stuff. It's got lots of things going for it. And the artwork's really nice as well. A bit scratchy, but that works with it.
Sounds good.
Yes. So that's us for today. We'll be back next time with more manga, comics, and various other things. All of our shows are available on Audioboom and iTunes, and the podcast provider of your choice. So if you are listening through any of those services, then subscribe and it'll keep you up to date. Our Patreon is now live, so if you are a regular listener, then show your support. Make a donation. It'll keep us running. It'll keep the lights on. It'll make sure we can eat and make sure we can buy more comics to tell you about them.
Otherwise, we'll just have to ferret it around in the bins outside Forbidden Planet.
Like good little rodents.
What, where they throw out all the comics that have gone past the sell-by date.
Yes, we'll be like good little rodents.
Running the risk of contretemps with Missile Mouse.
Yes. Oh, anyway.
Mads Mikkelsen.
Until next time, I have been Rob.
I've been Mick.
And I've been Andrew.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.